Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. And for those that are listening for the first time, the podcast is about shining a light on those bands that perhaps haven't had the publicity or haven't had the profile, particularly since the 1980s. And today, I'm also joined by my good friend, as usual, Noel. Hey, Noel, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Hello.
Now, Noel, today we're talking about The Truth. I know you know about The Truth, but do you know The Truth?
I know The Truth. I've seen the light. Yeah, I know The Truth. They're a band which probably, I think I'm probably what we kind of regard as our, as a kind of audience that we were looking for on this podcast, which is, I know a couple of bits, but there's a lot more to know, which is what this podcast is about. So I probably know a couple of the singles, and to be honest, that's it.
I'm definitely a big fan. So yeah. I guess, you know, my story starts in 83, I suppose. So between 83 and 84, I saw the band 40 times.
What? And 40?
Yeah.
4-0.
Wow. And some weeks I was seeing them, we were seeing them three times a week. And there was two other friends of mine that we used to go with, a guy called Lee Lawrence and Peter Dean. And those two guys, we just sort of followed the band around, whether they were supporting, whether they were headlining, whatever it was.
That's incredible. And I guess that also shows they were doing a lot of gigs then, if you were seeing them that often.
They were doing a lot of gigs. A lot of it was London-based, although we did sort of go elsewhere in the country. So the band consisted of Dennis Greaves, guitar and vocals, Mick Lister, guitar and vocals, Chris Scornia, Gary Wallace, and the bassist, which originally was a guy called Russell McKenzie, and then changed into Brian Bethel. And of course, as you know, Noel, today we're also talking to Mick Lister.
Yes.
Now,
yeah, yes,
you
he
know,
did,
we've
yeah.
recently spoken to Dennis about the Nine Below Zero story, and Mick will give us the full story about the truth. So that's coming up.
One thing I noticed actually was looking at the sort of the lineups, and obviously you talked about the original lineup there, and obviously they changed over time. I reckon, on just counting through, they've probably had about five different bassists and five different drummers. So quite a turnover of the amount of time going on there.
Of course, we spoke to the Cheaters, and they had a number of different bassists as well. So let's go back right to the beginning. So the band were formed in 82. And it was off the back of, for those that have listened to the Nine Below Zero episode, it was off the back of Nine Below Zero split up, and Dennis Greaves then decided that he had a new vision, wanted to move into the sort of music, into a 60s soul type, I guess, you know, with that sort of Hammond organ sound. And they built the sound of The Truth around that Hammond organ. Because 82 was when the Jam split up. You know, there was that mod sort of revival going on. And I guess maybe the Jam had left a bit of a gap in the market for those mod bands. And maybe The Truth came along and picked up some of that fan base.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when I was a massive Jam fan, when the Jam split for me, that was when I started to watch the Faith Brothers. So I was looking for a sound that, you know, I liked, that I found he sort of fitted in with the stuff that I liked.
I went to see Joe Jackson.
At
Aylesbury.
Yeah.
And on the Night and Day tour at that concert, Joe Jackson did two sets, first half and second half. In the interval, in the bar, basically, Dennis Greaves and Mick Lister were there. Well, you know, we couldn't believe it. So we were like straight in there. So like, oh, hi, Dennis. Hi, Mick. And and said, well, what are you up to? And he said, oh, we've just put together a band called The Truth. And we were like, right, okay, so we are going to now move our allegiances to the truth, and then we're going to really focus on them.
You might want to listen to him first, but yeah,
And I
but
think
you
that's
did.
why we ended
Yeah.
up going
Yeah.
to so many concerts over that
Wow.
time period. And I remember one particular event. We'd followed them around in those early days. They were playing the smaller venues like the Marquee and Dingwalls and, all of those places. But we
Good
went to
stuff.
Dingwalls, and there was no merch, there was no t-shirts, there was no they hadn't released anything. So we decided, the three of us, that we were going to make our own t-shirts.
Okay.
So we made our own Truth t-shirts in the style of, the Lonsdale style. And it was a style that Nine Below Zero also took. And we put the Truth and basically created some t-shirts, and we all wore them. And I remember we were sitting in the bar at Dingwalls, and the band came in and saw us and like, were, whoa, where did you get those t-shirts from? Oh, well, we made them. And from that sort of moment on, we had this affinity with the group,
Oh, that's
yeah.
brilliant.
So the band itself, they'd managed to get a record deal with Formation Records, and they released the first two singles. Basically, were Confusion Hits Us Every Time. Got to in actually into the charts at number 22,
That's quite good
and then they
for a
released
single.
a follow-up single called A Step in the Right Direction.
I really think
and that got to number 32 in the charts.
So good positions, though, for the first two singles, aren't they?
Yeah, really this good. Was 83. And actually, they were on Top of the Pops for both those singles as well. And you can, you know, people can see those performances on YouTube. And then suddenly, that was back in 83. No album had come out at that point. Yet they had a full set, you know, they were changing it all the time. I remember when we were going so often, you would be, you know, a bit of a set nerd. You know, you'd know exactly what was coming. So if they put a new song in, you know, it was like, right, okay, well, when's the album coming out? In 84, they had a single called No Stone Unturned.
And I think prior to that, if I was looking back on the information there, that they did a BBC Live recording in the Paris Theatre.
They did.
Just at the end of 83. Yeah, I went to that.
Did you? Yeah,
wow.
I went to that. And I think that has been released, that concert, on a CD box set a little while ago. But yes, they had quite a lot of profile in that time. Let's say they were on Top of the Pops a couple of times. They were on The Tube, A Midsummer Night's Tube. They were on another program called The Switch. I must admit, I've never heard of that.
Did I tell you this story before? That when the Style Council got together, when Weller joined, started the Style Council, the first ever gig they did was a CND gig in Brixton in the park. And me and Mark Thompson, you know, Tomo, we blagged our way backstage saying we worked for NME and we wanted to interview Paul Weller. And we actually get backstage. We couldn't find Weller, but we ended up hanging out with Madness in their dressing room. So then afterwards, I met a girl and I was telling her what we'd been up to. And she said, oh, I work for a new program on TV called The Switch. And she said, would you like to come and watch the Style Council? And she gave us tickets to go down to where they recorded it. So that's how we knew The Switch, because we actually turned up at the studio and watched it. Yeah.
Okay. So they were getting a lot of publicity. They were on the front cover of Record Mirror. And as I said before, the single No Stone Unturned was released in 84. But that was almost like a bit of a moment for them, because it didn't get in the chart. It got to number 66, I suppose.
Yeah.
So not top 40.
No.
And back in the 80s, early 80s, being in the chart was one of the key benchmarks to success, wasn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the record company wants to make some money on it, I guess. So,
they had planned to do an album with Formation. But because of the lack of success of No Stone Unturned, they were dropped from the record label. And then they signed to IRS, which was Miles Copeland's.
Right, yes.
Obviously is related to Stuart Copeland of The Police. So they then made three albums for IRS. Playground, which released the single Playground. Weapons of Love, which also released the single Weapons of Love, and then Jump back in further in into 1989. And those albums, when you listen to them compared to the first three or four singles, are very different in their sound.
It turns out they were on IRS for the first album, Playground. They moved to MCA Records for Weapons of Love. And I think that's why it got such a big success in the USA. Then they went back to IRS for Jump.
That does make sense, actually, because yeah. Weapons of Love and Jump are both what I would consider to be quite, I don't know, American orientated.
Yeah.
And have perhaps moved away a bit from that mod Motowny 60s soul-y type sound. And interesting enough, so Weapons of Love was quite commercially successful in the States. In this situation in which I've fallen, I can't seem to lose you. You have me down, 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 yeah. Everywhere I go to run, you're just a step away, just a step away. And I know that in my heart, your promises are just a kiss away. Oh, 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 weapons of love, stop hurting me. Oh, 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 weapons of love, they're killing me, yeah. Now I stand accused of the crime this time. You know, the title track was a hit single and reached number 7 on the rock chart, but number 65 on the Billboard 100. And another song from that album called The Edge of Town. Now, The Edge of Town was also featured in an episode of Miami Vice.
I mean, Miami Vice was like, you know, it was a really cool program at that point in time, wasn't it? Everyone loved it. It was like, you know, almost cutting edge and being cool. Back in the day.
It was massive. So obviously they were getting a bit more profile there. In 87, they actually were involved in creating the theme tune for a sci-fi film called The Hidden. I don't know if you've actually ever seen that film, but
No. They
used a track from Weapons of Love, and they also did the title track called The Hidden, which they released as a single. So that's the late 80s. And then in 89, they released Jump, which was... Yeah. Sort of final album that they made. Once again, quite an American influenced record.
They certainly started in a very kind of new mod sound, and it definitely evolved to a kind of a more rock sound towards the end of it. Going back actually just briefly, they did a few gigs, and they supported the Kinks, and they also supported Squeeze in the USA, and they swapped headlines between the two of them on different dates. They also did another BBC Live thing back in 84. They played at Chippenham Gold Diggers, and that was also on the radio. So just a couple of live tips there I thought I'd throw in.
So 89, they disbanded. Just a little potted history of what the people in The Truth did. So Mick Lister has gone on to write many songs, work with lots and lots of bands. He'll tell us more a little bit about that later on in the podcast. Chris Scornia, the Hammond organ guy, has just been playing with Elvis Presley's original backing band, interestingly enough.
Oh, the Jordanaires. Okay.
Jordanaires, yeah.
Right.
Brian Bethel then went on to work with the Blow Monkeys, but also then rejoined Nine Below Zero. Brian sadly passed away earlier on this year.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then Gary Wallace, who was the original drummer of The Truth, he went on to work with a whole list of people from Nick Kershaw, Duran Duran, The Power Station, Style Council. He was the percussionist on Our Favourite Shop. Has also played with Pink Floyd right the way through from 87, interestingly enough. Mike and the Mechanics, 10cc, and so on.
Brilliant. What a great background.
He's got an interesting CV in itself. Well, then in 2012, the Truth reform, and they played the Borderline Club in London.
Yes.
And they played with pretty much close to that original 83 lineup.
So at this point, right, this 2012 stuff, Nine Below Zero was still going. So
Yes, they
it's like
were.
a side project then, I guess.
And since then, they've been playing a lot of those sort of mod May Day Weekender type festivals and concerts.
Yes.
But obviously, Nine Below Zero have been quite active, so they've been releasing new material.
Yes.
But interestingly enough, so have The Truth. They've released two songs in the last, well, since 2019, one called Keep On Keeping On. And one called Soul on Fire. When you listen to them both, they're very truthy, if I can use that
Truthy, yeah.
if I can
I
use
mean,
that
obviously,
word.
Keep On Keeping On is the same title as the classic tune by the Redskins, of course.
Reds,
Another
yeah,
great band, another
exactly.
great band. Yeah,
And
interesting
then li
stuff.
literally a few years ago, they put to Cherry Red Records, 2016, 2016, 17, they Cherry Red put together a little box set of The Truth, and they had all the singles from the first time round with some demos on. They put the Paris Theatre one and the Chippenham Gold Diggers
Wow.
broadcast on that, and then also a what can only be described as a poor quality bootleg live at the Marquee that they also included on it. It's not great quality, but it's of its time, I suppose, and it's certainly pretty much was their set at the time, which I must have been at one of those.
You would have captured the raw energy of it.
I think that's
Yeah.
the kindest way of putting it.
Another connection, actually, a connection that we both have with the Truth is we've both got a mate called Derek D'Souza, who is a well-respected music photographer. And I got to know Derek when going to watch the Faith Brothers a lot. He was a big fan of theirs and went to a lot of their concerts. And I think you got to know him when you used to go and see the Truth a lot.
I
And
did. And interestingly enough, the front cover of the box set was, I think, a Derek D'Souza photo.
fantastic.
I think from a Truth perspective, that's pretty much the sort of potted history of the band,
Yeah.
Noel. Let's now have a chat with Mick Lister and hear from Mick the sort of full story of the band. Welcome, Mick.
Nice to meet you both.
Can we start by perhaps you talking about some of your initial inspirations? What were you listening to as a young guy growing up?
When I was six, I used to get palmed over to my grandma's in High Wycombe every holidays, and my mum, God rest her soul, she had a younger sister about 20 years younger, and she was into the Beatles. So I was listening to like Magical Mystery Tour when I was like six. So and that was like a real inspiration. I'm just seeing the cover with the walrus and that sort of stuff going on there. So I think it was my auntie that was really fired me into that early Beatles sort of stuff, because I'm from Aylesbury and Bucks, and my schoolmates, we formed a band when we were 11 years old.
Oh,
And
the Stowaways.
yeah, well,
Yeah.
it Before that, it was such a bad name. There's three of us, so we were called us the dad called us TriStar. We had his three. We went to the market and bought these jumpers with three stars on it. He called us TriStar. So that was when we were doing covers. So we would do like covers,
Right.
and then when obviously when the punk thing came out, we started writing our own songs, and that progressed in that situation. And when the punk thing came out, because when we were in a band doing covers, we were doing like Beatles and Everly Brothers and Yellow River and all that sort of stuff, and
Sort of classics, yeah.
the classics. And then when the punk thing came out, obviously, the power pop was more the things I was led to, like the more song-based artists, like Elvis Costello and The Jam and the Ruby News and all those kind of really cult bands from America as well, and Blondie. So I was always lent to the more melodic kind of bands, and of course The Jam. I saw The Jam probably 30 times as a kid.
Oh, that's fantastic.
They used to play Aylesbury, in the black and white suits in 77 and in
Yes.
the Modern World and all that sort of stuff. I saw The Clash and The Police. I saw The Police on their first album there. I mean, the amount of bands that came there, including Nine Below Zero, by the way. I mean, I was a massive fan of Nine Below. So I was, and because I was in a local band, the Stowaways, at this, you should check out the Club Friars, by the way. The bands that I saw Talking Heads headline with Dire Straits third on the bill. The
Wow.
bands that came there was incredible. The Clash, Ian Dury, So my apprenticeship as a songwriter and as a musician was, we used to go to fires every week, and the bouncers used to get me in because I was like in a band, and I just saw the most incredible bands, and it never ever happened again, So, and of course I saw Nine Below Zero there, and I became a massive fan of them. I love Dennis's energy, and again, it was right up my street. And I used to go and see them at Hope and Anchor with a mate of mine from Aylesbury called Neil Smart, who's a massive Nine Below fan. Saw them at the Hammersmith Odeon.
So when you met Dennis then, so
Yes.
I met you in because I used to go to Friars as well. I saw Joe Jackson on his Night and Day tour there,
Oh,
and
amazing.
you were at that concert
Was I?
because yes, you were,
Okay.
because I met you and Dennis in the you were in like the in the sort of break. He did two sets, first
Yes.
half, second half.
Yeah.
And we were big Nine Below Zero fans, and we were like, oh no, what's happened? And he said, okay, what are you doing now? And I think he was saying then, well, we formed a new band with The Truth. This is, this is Mister. But how did all that come about?
When the Stowaways packed up, because they never really had the sort of drive that I had. They were, it was hard work, and so the band split up, and then I was in another really bad band with a friend of mine. I won't name his name, but Dennis put an advert in a Melody Maker. So, and my mate rang me up and he said, "We should go for this." I said, "Oh, fuck off, won't get that." So anyway, so my mate organised the audition, and we went down to, God, it was a rehearsal studio in Lordship Lane down in South London somewhere. And of course, I was a big fan of Dennis, and it's a bit weird, because it's like seeing someone that you just want to go as a fan, And we were told to learn a Nine Below song, which was "Wipe Away Your Kiss." So me being me, I did my homework. So what I did, I thought, well, I'm not going to dominate Dennis as a guitarist, because I was a strictly rhythm guitarist anyway. So I'd worked out what a second guitarist would do on that song. Also, I was pretty good at high girly harmonies. So I made sure I looked pretty good that day. And so on that audition, Dennis had a drummer and a bass player there. And so he asked my bass player to go out and play. He did his bit. So then he asked me to get up, and I says, "Well, I can't play unless you play, Dennis." So Dennis went, "Oh, what's going on here?" So Dennis got his guitar, And we did Wipe Away Your Kiss. And of course, I did all the secondary guitar parts. And obviously, I used my brain. And on that day, Dennis asked me to come back like six times.
Oh, fantastic.
He said, because there's an audition play, there's about 300 guitarists went for the job. So
Wow.
I just kept going. And he said, come back in an hour. And then come back in an hour. So I did that. And so at the end of that day, I felt pretty good because I thought, you know what? He's kept asking me to come back. And so I was living at my mum's then, and he said, I'll give you a call in the morning. So the next morning, I get that, and I was shitting it, you know, because I mean, at that time, I was working as like on a building site, just earning some money. And this was going to be a big breakthrough, you know, to play in the band with Dennis Greaves would be amazing. So anyway, the next morning, he called me, and in Dennis's gruff voice, he said, hello, is that me? I went, yeah. And he said, yeah, about your bass player. I went, yeah. He says, I thought he was shit. Blatant Dennis. And then he said, I'd like to offer you a part in the band. So then it was like, oh my God, you know, and then my life kind of changed. And then I kind of lived with Dennis and his wife in Tulsa Hill at the time. And then Dennis realized I could write songs. And so we started writing songs together. So, and we built up this relationship. I was more of I'd say, a commercial writer than Dennis, because Dennis was down a blues avenue. So I brought my inspiration of melodic songs and the cross section of our writing styles together made it the truth. And of course, I was into Tamla Motown and the Beatles, and you know, and it's just a great marriage of, you know, and of course we both love football as well. I mean, I'm a mad Evertonian, and Dennis is a Spurs fan, so you know, and we love sport and stuff. And I played football, and I started playing for Dennis's Sunday football side, you know, and it was good. And we just built up a relationship as like you know, a writing duo.
Fantastic. So what was
Yeah.
that first song that you wrote together then?
I think it might have been something like Out of the Darkness, I think. I don't think it was ever really recorded. I think it might have recorded at the Marquee, I think, on a live thing or something. But
Yeah, it was a B-side of Exception of Love.
was that live?
No, that wasn't live.
No, well, I
But
think it was around that sort of time. And no, actually, there was a song called Bring Love Into My World. That was the first one. Oh, yeah, so yeah, I'm just trying to recall now. It's like, such a long time ago. But yeah, Bring Love Into My World was, I think, one of the first songs. Out of the Darkness, all that sort of stuff.
what were those early days like then? What was that, you know, as you were, because obviously Dennis had, you know, 9 by 0 split, he was starting this new band, had to start pretty much from not quite the beginning. He had a name, but, you know, to
Yeah,
build up his profile
I
again.
think initially, I think a lot of the Nine Below fans thought he might have sold out a little bit because it was, again, a lot more commercial. But you know, and then of course we introduced the Hammond organ as well, which was so fucking heavy. You know, I mean, that was dragging that around the gigs was a nightmare.
Oh,
But
God.
yeah, I mean, I think when we started playing gigs, I think we'd play like the Half Moon in Tulsa.
Putney.
Not Putney, the other one,
Oh, all right.
Herne Hill. And we'd play our own songs, and we'd put like four or five Nine Below Zero songs in there, like Sugar Pie Honey Bunch.
Sugar beet, wasn't it?
Sugar Beet,
Did
yes.
sugar beet? I think you
White
did
Boy Orchid.
homework, maybe.
Yeah, possibly. And then we'd do I think might have done Mystery Man, I'm not sure. But we did a few just to satisfy a few Nine Below fans, I think. So
Yeah, I came to the Torrington, the Finchley Torrington,
yes. Yeah,
which I
that was
think was
one of my favorite ones.
probably maybe the second or third
Yes.
one that
Yeah.
you did.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had various different bass players at that time as well. We were just kind of nurturing the band along, and obviously me and Dennis had that strong relationship. Chris Corney on Hammond, Gary Wallace on drums. But we did have a problem with bass players at first.
Yeah, it was Russ McKenzie, was it?
Russ McKenzie, yeah, and a few other Herberts before that, and it was a bit of a problem night. And of course, then Brian Bethell came on board when we signed, which was amazing, bless his soul. Yeah.
Yeah, so sorry to hear about that as well.
Yeah, he'd had a lot of health problems though. But it's always sad and quite a reminder of like life, really.
So that early period, there seemed to be a lot of optimism, and then you got into Formation Records. How did that all come about then?
Yeah, well, we had quite, I mean, I think basically because of Dennis's name, I mean, he had a few legal problems with A&M. He was still kind of linked to his publishing deal with Rondeau, I think. So it wasn't that clear cut, but we got a lot of interest. We had Stiff Records interested at the time, and Clive Banks at Formation, which was Warner Brothers. I remember doing, I think we were playing St. Albans at the time, and Clive Banks came down, and he seemed to be a really good option for the band. And I think also Dennis was like, he was a leader. I mean, I was like 21. I was just hanging on to his coattails. It's like it was all new for me. And from being a bricklayer on a building site and in local bands to like getting a professional record deal. And it was such a whirlwind for me. And I think if I knew now what I knew then, I think I knew then what I knew now, I think I think a lot of things would have changed because we will go on to Swain and Jolly as producers.
They produce Spandau Ballet and Bananarama and so on.
Yeah, but I mean, that was so wrong. I mean, we had the chance of Langer Winstanley that did
Oh,
Mad
wow.
Dexys. They were up for producing it, but Dennis chose Swain and Jolly. And
Right.
it was such a wrong choice. They were just not really. I mean, having said that, I've produced Tony Haddie's last two albums and written for him. So
Oh, well, there you
that's a bit of connection there.
What goes around comes around, I guess.
Absolutely. He's a good guy. He's a gooner, but he's all right. He's a good guy. So.
There's always that sort of problem, isn't
Now,
it?
he's actually Tony Hadd is he's a real solid guy. He's a lot of the artists I work with are a little bit flaky now and again, but Tony's a really solid guy, and I've got a lot of respect for him.
So that first couple of singles then, Confusion and Step in the Right Direction, that seemed to generate a huge amount of optimism around the band.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, this is the thing with record companies, especially big ones. The guy that signed us was a guy called Charles Leveson. He was the MD of the company. And as soon as we signed to Formation, he left.
Oh.
So, and then we had, what's it, Rob Dickens came in at Warner Brothers, who hated us.
Right. So your sponsor that was behind you had your back,
Yes.
disappeared immediately. Ah, what
Yeah,
a
but this
nightmare.
happens a lot in record labels, I've learned, so the people that champion the MD had gone. So we had Rob Dickens come in, didn't like us. And so after the third single, No Stone, and there was a lot going on after the first two singles, and we lost a lot of direction there, I feel, because it wasn't all about making great power pop type songs. It was, I think Dennis was speaking, he made friends with lots of people, and I think Dennis was quite influenced by a lot of other people. And like the time he was mates with this designer, and we wore those really shit jumpers and in a boarding hut, and it was just stuff like that that wasn't. It's like, oh, fucking hell. And we did the third single, No Stone Unturned, and we got dropped by the label, and it was inevitable, and it was a tough time, a real tough time, that one.
So that then brought on IRS records then after that.
Yes. I mean, again, This is the other thing that a lot of people don't understand is that we had that choice of signing with IRS, which was Miles Copeland, the police's manager, or split up. And at that stage, Miles Copeland only wanted it. He wanted it to be like a Hall and Oates thing, like a duo, me and Dennis. So we were under a lot of pressure to sack the band to do that. It was that it was either sink or swim and do that. And of course, Miles Copeland said to us, okay, you're going to have a career in America now, and you will be doing this. You won't be doing what you're doing because we want to break you in America. So, the reason why our music changed was because of that. And a lot of people don't know that. They think, oh, we just sold out this and that. But a lot goes on behind the scenes, and it was never, ever an easy ride. We were lucky to because we toured America and we played some amazing places, and we did really well. We had a lot, almost like a top 40 hit out there. But we came back and got slaughtered by the mods because we wanted to make a living in music, and we were under a lot of pressure to change the style and make it quite AOR, which was the American market.
You do Top of the Pops though, mate.
Yeah, and yeah, again, that was a lifetime ambition. I'd watch Top of the Pops ever. When I was my first recollection of music was seeing the Four Tops do Reach Out, I'll Be There in 1966 on Top of the Pops. And that blew my mind. And from then on, like Thursday nights with Cocoa Pops, or else Sugar Puffs, watching that was everything. And to be on Top of the Pops was, I had two ambitions. To be on Top of the Pops and to play for us as a headlining act, and luckily we did that, which was great.
Fantastic. So I read somewhere that you hung out with Marillion on the backstage at Top of the Pops,
Yeah,
became
well, what it
mates.
was, it was because Marillion are from Aylesbury, my hometown.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so we did Top of the Pops. Our first Top of the Pops was Marillion's first Top of the Pops. So there was a massive local thing in the Bucks, Aylesbury local papers, like local boys have done good. So there was that connection, the Aylesbury connection with me and Fish and all the boys from Marillion that were doing Top of the Pops for the first time. So
Oh, wow, that's brilliant.
that was that. And Fish used to come and watch the Truth a lot at the Marquee.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
Wow.
he'd be in a bar watching us a lot,
I wouldn't want to stand behind him. He's
No,
fairly tall.
you wouldn't.
So
No.
did I mean, how did you get on with the miming? I mean, that must have been a challenge, must it? Or
It's easy
oh, you
because
just do it. Yeah.
you spend so long recording vocals, it's no, it's a lot easier than people think.
All right, that's okay then.
The only thing that was difficult for me was when we redid the Truth later on in the last few years, Dennis would always forget the lyrics, so I'd be looking over the because I'd be harmonizing and I'd have to try and guess what he's going to sing. But that became an art form in itself,
Yeah.
Okay, so you definitely mentioned about that sort of switching sound from, those first few singles and then into Playground and then into Weapons of Love and Jump.
Yeah, let me just fill you in on that because I've forgotten about Playground. What happened was when we'd got dropped, we'd had a load of songs. When we signed to IRS, the songs like Spread a Little Sunshine, Playground, they were already written. So that's why they came out. It was the Weapons of Love album that had that massive departure. So like the Playground, it was still the ilks of what we were all about, just letting you know that.
Much heavier production, though, I thought, on Playground.
Yeah, well, I think it was because it was us saying, well, we don't want that Swain and Jolly sound. We're going to actually do what we really want to do here. So that was Playground was all that. That was just the Who, it was.
And then to get to that Weapons of Love and, a bit further on Jump, how did your songwriting change then? Because it was definitely a different sound. How did that all evolve?
Yeah, I think we spent a lot of time in America, in LA, writing that record, and we were quite influenced by a lot of stuff on MTV and stuff like that. So we were definitely told which direction to go in. And me as a songwriter was quite an easy thing to do because since then I've written for loads of different artists, and I never found it that difficult. I just, I'd latch onto it and just do it. So it was a departure. I was okay with it. I was really okay. We were in LA having a great time and, working with a great producer called Dennis Herring, who was an amazing producer. I learned a lot from him. And for me, it was just, I think as an artist, you have to evolve. Now, when The Truth first initially finished, I got into songwriting for other artists, and I felt and I could do that. And it was great not to do the same thing all the time. You know, it's refreshing. And then I started producing for other artists, you know. So it became really refreshing to do that, you know, as to doing that same old thing, you know. And I didn't want to be up and down the M1 doing clubs. I really didn't, you know. It was a fresh new challenge for me. And I got a publishing deal. And then I was just, you know, I just did that. So again, it was evolving for me.
How does that work though, mate? So you've just come off the back of a band, and then suddenly you start writing songs. How do other artists then pick up those songs, and how does that all?
No, what happened was, to be quite honest, when The Truth finished, I just thought it was all going to come to me, and it didn't. And then when my daughter was born in 96, that gave me the kick up the arse to say, okay, you've got responsibilities here. So I reconnected with our old manager, Mickey Modden, who put a couple of things my way. And one of them was a guy called Steve Balsamo, who played Jesus Christ Superstar, who just signed to Columbia Records. And I ended up writing his first single. And then from then on, I got a publishing deal. And then that's when, you know, I'd just start working with other artists. You know, I'd go to Sweden and Denmark to do writing trips and stuff like that. I went to Nashville to do writing there and New York. And I've been doing that ever since. So that's how that happened, you know.
I heard you work with Amy Winehouse as well. That must have been interesting.
Yeah, well, I worked with her when she was 17, and the song never got released, but we actually wrote it on 9/11 that day. So, and ironically, the song was called Long Day, and we didn't even know nothing was happening, you know. But quite nice to say, what you did on 9/11, I was working with Amy Winehouse. So,
Yeah, wow.
yeah, she was
Brilliant.
amazing. She was amazing. Yeah.
Going back a bit. You got involved in a movie called The Hidden. And did like the theme tune for that.
Long road I have traveled.
And I think they used one of the Weapons of Love tracks as well.
What happened there was IRS, the record label, were very good at getting stuff into films. They were really good at doing that. And that opportunity came when we were actually, I think it was 1987, I think we'd just done an album, and then the opportunity came to write or co-write this. I think that there was already a song there. Me and Dennis sort of finished it off, and then we went over to LA to produce it with Roy Thomas Baker. That's done everyone, you know, from Bohemian Rhapsody to The Cars to The Foreigner, you know, and we produced that track out there, did a video for it. Yeah, and that got in a movie. Yeah, that's how that happened.
They also used one of the tracks in Miami Vice as well.
Yes. Yeah, well, I don't even know anything about that. I mean, my brother-in-law gave me a call one night. He said, I just heard one of your songs on Miami Vice. I said, nah, you ain't. But I think at that time, it was so cool to be in Miami Vice, like
Yeah,
U2,
it was. Yeah.
you know, and it's like, wow, you know, we had this song, Edge of Town, that was in that. So that was, again, a little bit of an ambition, that, to get a song in Miami Vice.
Yeah,
You
I think
know,
I didn't you say you nearly fell off the sofa when you I was in
heard
the same boat, actually. I was watching the episode. I was like, oh, God, I know that song.
No, I mean, obviously, at that time, there wasn't the internet. So I think we had to wait for another rerun of Miami Vice to actually believe we were on it. So yeah, it was good. It's lovely.
You also toured with like George Thorogood and the Kinks, and I know others as well, but what was that like?
Yeah, we did one gig with George Thorogood. That was on my 21st birthday, actually, at the Hammersmith Palais.
Hammersmith Palais, I was there.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. So that was one gig. But we did two tours with the Kinks, and that was great. I mean, you know, Ray Davies is a massive influence on my writing, and Dennis's. And it was just great to see the history and how Ray Davies would have the fans in the palm of his hand, you know. And it was on that Come Dancing tour. They did that album then.
Yeah.
And it was quite great because, you know, we'd have Mick Avery telling the stories. Me and Dennis, we were like two little boys in the hotel. He'd be telling the stories about, you know, and it was just fascinating, you know. It's just history, isn't it? You know, and
yeah.
Iconic history. Yeah. I mean, Ray Davis and Dave Davis was fighting all the time, though. It was quite shocking. You know, we'd be backstage and just hear like fisticuffs going on. It's a bit like Liam and Noel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but it was quite, you know. Sometimes they'd be on late on stage because they'd had this rock behind the scenes. So, but there you go, brotherly love.
So you played on the Tube. I think it was a Midsummer Night's Tube.
Yes,
and you did a cover of the Equals. I get so excited. How did that come about?
Well, we'd always like to do covers in our gigs. Dennis has got quite an extensive collection of, you know, albums, and he was a massive Equals fan. And we'd just go at his house and just play stuff, and we decided to have a little go at that. And yeah, that's how that came about. You know, it's just that, you know, amongst other loads of covers we did, you know, just, but we'd love that, you know, because it's like, especially like we do Reach Out, I'll Be There, you know, and that always went down like such a great song. That was,
oh, brilliant. Look, about that time, March 1989, I was looking at a bit of research, and I saw that The Truth supported Nine Below Zero. So I can't, this was in Rotherhithe, I think, in London. I can't work out how that happened, how that worked. Do you remember that? And did Dennis do a bit of both? Or
No, I don't. I think what that was The Truth had kind of finished, I think, and Dennis had reformed Nine Below. And I think the only part of The Truth was me coming on stage for a couple of songs and doing a couple of songs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was just trying to work out how that would work.
I don't think it would work in real life.
Twisted my melon, that one.
Yeah.
Because you obviously kept in touch. Obviously, I know you've kept in touch. Obviously, we'll come on to the reunion in a second. But obviously, you also played with Nine Below Zero on some of their albums, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, there was a couple of the songs that we'd written after we'd got dropped by IRS, actually, because the album Jump was the last one, because they were pretty useless over here, IRS. So we'd written a couple of songs, and Dennis put them in on a couple of his albums. So I would come and do the parts that he couldn't do, and the highest girly vocals and stuff like that. Yeah.
And okay, so, and then how did the reunion then come about? Because we're moving rapidly forward now.
Yeah, well, me and Dennis, we kind of lost touch, really, because I was in my world and Dennis was in, and it was only at Anthony Hart's 40th birthday party in Coventry that I went and Dennis went, and we re-hooked up and went hello, and then we got in contact then. But we were out of touch about 12 years, you know, for whatever reason. You know, it's like anything, you know. I have loads of musician friends that I haven't seen for years, and you know, you just carry on in your world and you just lose touch, and that's an unfortunate part of human nature, really. But we reconnected, and then I think in 2012 Dennis was asked to do the Truth gig, and I wasn't really that keen because I was doing my own stuff, and then he twisted my arm, and then we came back and did a couple of shows then, and we did, you know, probably three or four gigs a year, just to, you know, just to tread the boards.
you sort of bring the band, or I don't know whether it's Dennis that brings the band back or both of you, but it sort of feels like it's quite occasional.
Oh, it's very, yeah, it's very occasional, very occasional. You know, a couple of years ago, it became quite apparent to me that, you know, Dennis's agent, Adrian Gibson, they had no intention of looking after the truth at all, you know. And for me, it just became a bit of huff and puff and a lot of work for just two gigs a year, because, you know, you'd spend the first day letting Dennis, because it's hard for Dennis because he's got Nine Below and the Truth. So to put the truth head on from Nine Below is, you know, so you'd have lyrics everywhere, you know, a lot of work, you know, to do two gigs and then nothing, you know. So Adrian Gibson, the agency, didn't want to do the truth, and I'd try to get a few festivals, and it was just a lot of work, you know. And if there's no demand for it, then it's not worth it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and you did release some new material, though. You had a couple of singles, Soul on Fire.
Yeah. This is stuff that I produced. Yeah, I mean, that we did that because a year and a half ago, we did like a tour with the Mods May Day thing, and we wanted something to promote. So we did the track Soul on Fire. And before that, we did Keep on Keeping On. Yeah. So it's more of a promotional thing. You know, I mean, it's hard to get something promoted when you haven't got a lot of money to do it, you know, but I'd like to think the quality control was pretty good.
Also, you mentioned that you've worked with, obviously, producing and writing. And obviously, I mentioned Amy Winehouse. I think you did some stuff with Rankin Roger.
Yeah, bless his soul. I mean, yeah, I did his last two albums, wrote and produced them.
Yeah.
I built up with a mate. Yeah, there we go. He was the most beautiful person, you know, such a good soul. He was really ill. Because the second album, Public Confidential, never got really promoted because he was ill. I went to see him the day before he died. I went up to Birmingham Hospital.
Wow.
And he was such a spiritual chap. And I went to his bedside, and I had a Harrington on, and he got my zip, and he did my zip up. He didn't want me to get cold. Bless. He was such a beautiful soul. And that broke my heart. You know, I had such a great relationship with Roger. You know, it was, and it was one of those things, you know, when I first worked with him, I went up to Birmingham on the train, and he was meet me at the top of the station. And I thought, fuck, that's Rankin Roger, you know. And it's like, Jesus Christ, you know, it's like that one of those moments, you know.
Yeah.
Then we just became amazing mates. And, you know,
I mean, they have got some fantastic tracks on them. You know, some of these, they really got back to that sound, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was my aim, you see.
Yeah,
that was
well,
my
definitely aim. Worked.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for that. That's a compliment.
So you work with Tony Hadley. I mean, are there any other names you can mention that you've worked with?
Oh God, I've done a lot of pops. A real lot of. When I first signed a publishing deal, I've worked with lots of pop, like S Club and Gareth Gates and BB Mac, and just loads of pop artists. And you know, it's like I found it a real discipline to go into that situation and be able to do that. You know, and latch on to that whatever they're doing musically, and you know, and that's what makes it really interesting for me, because it's not the same thing, you know. And I've always wanted to evolve, and I do a lot of stuff. I've had a lot of stuff in film trailers and film syncing big movies, I've worked with the most amazing artist called Cynthia Erivo. If you check her out now, she's won a Grammy. She's from the theatre world. She's an amazing singer. And I wrote a song with her back in 2012 called Fly Before You Fall, which got in a big movie in the US. And I went to the film premiere and sat next to Diane Warren, who'd written a song in there, who's an amazing songwriter. And, you know, it's like, whoa. And I've been doing a lot of that. I've got a song in a big film called A Simple Favor, which is a massive worldwide film. And I've done film trailers for stuff in Sky Movies and stuff like that. And so again, I just love composing. I love it because I've got my own studio and I like to think I've evolved as a composer and a musician, you know. And my job every day is just amazing because I can do that and I want to do it, you know.
So do people come to you now then? Now you've obviously well established, but do people come to you and ask you to do stuff?
Yeah. I'll get offers to do. I think if it's something that's really contemporary and I would take it on. I've gone away from doing too much of the poppy stuff now because I've gone more into film scores and stuff like that. And I've actually written a musical with my daughter. So my daughter is now 28. She went to the Royal Central School of Acting, which after uni, she auditioned. And that drama school was Laurence Olivier went there, Judi Dench and Martin Freeman. They all went to that drama school. Wow. So in COVID, she was living back at home with me and my wife. She said, can we write a musical? Because I want to write a version of Wuthering Heights. So we started that and then it escalated and we got a West End director on board and so. And I've ended up doing at the moment 25 songs and 15 underscores. And we workshopped it in March in London and we had top West End actors and actresses involved. My daughter wrote the script. She's playing Kathy in Wuthering Heights. If you go on Instagram and look at Wuthering Heights, the musical, you'll see a lot of what's been going on. And we've just done a workshop for the industry and we're just waiting. We've got some really good news coming really shortly. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
I've turned into a bit of a lovey.
Brilliant. I love that.
That's brilliant. Best of luck with that one. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, but I mean, if you check Wuthering Heights, the musical on Instagram, you'll see what's going on.
So if you look back then, what would you say has been your greatest memory?
Yeah, I mean, okay, let's go for the truth. I think the greatest memory of the truth would be doing Top of the Pops, the very first one where, you know, you had those women in front dancing and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we all had the black suit, black outfits on, like Milk Tray Men and Burns guitars. And, you know, I think, I don't think you can beat that first moment because that was the first ever live Top of the Pops. Top of the Pops used to be recorded on a Tuesday and it used to go out on a Thursday. But for some reason or other, they started doing live Top of the Pops. So it went out live on a Thursday night. So if you fell over, that
couldn't
was
do it again.
You could do it again. No, that was quite a lot of pressure as well. So but I think that Top of the Pops would be that. I think on another note, I think to write a musical with my daughter and see it take fruition with West End actors, West End directors, producers, and casting directors, that's been a massive. And also going to a film premiere in LA with that film Beyond the Lights, sat next to Diane Warren, who'd written a song in that movie too, you know, that's a quite a big moment to get on a red carpet and do that sort of stuff. So I'm quite blessed to do that.
I mean, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
No, it's been
open. I know it's probably been a trip down memory lane for you.
Yeah.
I know the people listening to the podcast will absolutely love hearing about it.
Thank you, Martin. And thank you so much, both of you. It's been a real
Cheers.
Pleasure.
Thank you. It's been great.
I think it's a great job you're doing because I think, again, the passion and obviously the research you've done is amazing. And I think, you know, the more stuff like this comes out, I think it's brilliant.
Thank you
so much for your time.
Cheers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources. But of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, then you can, of course, contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, The Uncharted 80s. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.